The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
This morning, a demand for answers here after the deadly mass shooting at this supermarket in Buffalo, New York, that authorities say was driven by racist hate.
This is an absolute racist hate crime. This is someone who has hate in their heart, soul, and mind.
An 18-year-old gunman opening fire at this top supermarket around 2:30 in the afternoon Saturday, killing 10 people and injuring three others.
Active shooter at the top. There are still shots being fired.
This is the moment authorities arrested Peyton Gendron after he unleashed terror on shoppers and employees, starting in the parking lot and then continuing inside.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, horrible, right? 10 people were killed when a mass shooting erupted at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, in what authorities believe was a racist hate crime carried out by a white gunman who drove for hours to get there. You know, it's, I don't have an explanation for it. It's just twisted and it's very sick. Is there mental illness? There very well could be. I think anybody who behaves like that certainly is not in their right mind. Could there be something spiritual behind it? There certainly could be. I also think that there's also a lot of copycat shootings. You hear about these being reported and all of a sudden there's like a flurry of them, right? I often wonder about that. That was horrible news. Came out Saturday from Buffalo, and it just adds another deadly shooting, you know, to our nation's already too long list of them. I happened to be watching the news in the Chicago area. I think it was Sunday or Monday. And there were like 26 shootings over that weekend. I'm thinking, beautiful city, right? Great people. 26 shootings? What the heck is going on? This case here, though, you got an 18-year-old kid. And I know some are calling for the death penalty. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. His life's over. 18 years old. Walks into a supermarket on Saturday afternoon. Just started shooting. No, he killed 10 people. He wounded three more. He had a 180-page manifesto. 180-page. Try to write. I wrote a 140-some-page book. Right? Imagine a 180-page manifesto. He said that he was looking for Jews. He was looking for blacks. And according to the state's or to the city police commissioner, he planned that. And that he planned that if he escaped from the store, he was going to go to another one. So at one point, Gendron said he became radicalized over the last couple of years by what he read online. And before that, he'd been just a normal teenager, right? This is the scary part. I know a kid who I was talking to not too long ago has been online, right? And yeah, normal kid. I mean, I have known him for a long time. And then he started talking to me about, like, saying stuff that was anti-Semitic. I'm like, where did you hear that? Oh, you go look online. You'll see this. You'll see. And I'm thinking, this is how that type of grooming, maybe, or indoctrination, radicalization takes place. You think it would never happen to anybody you know. Look at this kid's parents, 18 years old, 180-page manifesto. He went online and went on the hunt to kill fellow human beings. Been a normal teenager is what people are saying. Then the lockdown happened. At all sorts of time, I guess, to read radical material online. Of course, he pleaded not guilty to the charges. He'll appear again in court later this week. The question, and this is what I want to look at right now. How do we stop this kind of thing from happening? You know, you'll hear the mantra and the chant on the streets, you know, no guns, right? People want to take guns away when you hear something like that. And with more of these shootings, many people might say, well, you know, maybe my attitude's changing on that, right? How do we stop it? It's not just about the guns, right? I think there's something much deeper. This is obviously rooted in hate. So how do you prevent hate? How do we do that? Charles Fain Lehman, he's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor to City Journal. He joins me today, and we'll take a look at that together. Great to have you with me today, Charles. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you here. You know, this kind of thing to me just seems so, one, it's unpredictable. You got a normal kid who somehow, you know, became infected with, you know, a radical ideology and then goes out and kills innocent people. Are there ways to predict something like this? Are there tells that are out there? I mean, what should parents look for? What should local communities look for? I mean, are there ways that we can preempt this just by maybe being more aware?
I mean, you know, I think it's on the one hand, it's hard. On the other hand, often you'll find that kids like this, potential offenders like this, there are flags, people recognize beforehand. You'll go talk to neighbors, you'll go talk to friends, you'll go talk to family members, school administrators. I mean, think about the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland, Florida. The offender there had been kicked out of school over and over and over again and allowed to come back, as my former colleague Max Eden has written about. You know, I think we'll dig into the details of this case going forward, but I will not be surprised if there were red flags. And, you know, you got to be willing to be proactive about red flags, which we're often uncomfortable with, but it's necessary.
That's really true. So, I mean, again, we hear about hate crimes. Clearly, this appears to be one. Why do hate crimes matter? Let's talk about them. How do you view hate crimes?
Absolutely. You know, and I think that there's some disagreement about hate crimes. A lot of people say, look, why should we punish hate over and above a regular crime? If I punch you, I punch you.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I understand that perspective. I think the way that I think about it, there are a couple of different ways that I think about it. The first way is that, you know, there's something special about hate-based offending. There's a special kind of additional harm. And in most cases, you know, a hate crime charge is, you know, it's a sentencing enhancement. If I punch somebody because he's a different race from me, right, I think that there's an additional cognizable harm there over and above the simple act of punching. There's a harm to him. You can also say there's a harm to the community because they are made more afraid. You talk about, you know, if somebody beats up a Jewish guy walking down the streets in New York, right, every other Jew is a little more worried. And, you know, I think the strong argument that I would make is, look, the function of hate crime laws is, you know, there are certain behaviors in a society as complicated and diverse, rich with variety as ours, that can't be tolerated. The goal of hate crime laws is to say, we got to be able to get along. Certain actions cannot be allowed. They have to be especially condemned. And that's what hate crime laws protect against.
Yeah, I was always on the fence on them, to be honest with you. I see both sides, and I see the case for it. But I think if somebody burns down my house because I happen to be an Italian or a Catholic, they're charged for arson, but they can now also, because if they don't like my Catholicism, I guess be charged with a heavier crime, although it's still arson. They could burn the guy across the street who may not be. I mean, so it's tough, but I do understand how if this ripples through a community, the African-American community, the Jewish community, how suddenly, you know, it has a much broader impact. Do police programs that target hate crimes work? I mean, what are we doing right now on the street to say, okay, we need to get to the heart of this? I mean, these hate crimes, I've never seen anything like them, and they seem to be happening with increasing frequency. What are the police doing? Anything at all that's effective?
So, look, there are two levels, this investigation and then this deterrence. From an investigative perspective, potential hate offenders leave a lot of evidence out on the internet. You usually, again, you're able to recognize in advance if you pour the time and money and resources into it. And so you put time, money into investigations. But then it's also the case that, you know, a lot of the hate crimes you don't hear about, the low-profile stuff, somebody beats somebody up while screaming a slur, those guys are not, you know, they don't, as we would say, specialize in hate crime offending. If you're the kind of guy who thinks it's a good idea to beat the heck out of somebody walking down the street, you're probably also the kind of guy who thinks it's a good idea to call them a dirty word while you do it. And so, you know, I think hate crimes are ultimately a public safety issue. They're a matter for law enforcement. Putting cops into areas where there are hate crimes, where hate crimes are happening, hotspots for hate crime, is an effective strategy for reducing the overall level. It's not necessarily going to start with something like this terrible shooting in Buffalo, but it may help keep, you know, the average person walking down the street a little safer.
Yeah, I know you wrote a piece recently on the need to focus on mental health. And you look at some of these guys, some shootings in just recent days, recent weeks. Clearly, there's a mental disturbance there. How do we approach it? Are we failing as a society to you know, help those who really need this type of mental health? What do we do? What do we need to focus on? You know, we've got the radicalization that we've seen in this case, but clearly there's a lot of cases where people just are not in their right mind. They're mentally ill that commit these egregious crimes, like the shooter in New York and so many others. Maybe share a little bit about what you wrote on that.
Sure. Well, you know, I think at scale, look, it's a big, hard problem. The sort of short version that I give you is mental illness has been for a variety of reasons, is not given sufficient priority, particularly people who are seriously violently mentally ill are not given sufficient priority. And what I mean by priority is that we sort of see this trade-off. We say, oh, you don't want to get you don't want to commit them. You don't want to compel them to do anything that they don't want to do. You really have to trust them. You have to let them guide the process. And that's ultimately harmful. If you're not in your right mind, you're not competent to do that. So in a state like New York, there's not enough involuntary commitment. There's not enough involuntary outpatient treatment. There's not enough treatment capacity. There aren't enough beds. That's a problem with federal policy, with state policy. We don't take that problem seriously enough, and we don't do for those people enough of what we need to do. That's the root of the issue.
Well, I'm grateful for your insight and your writing, Charles. Thanks for being with us. If people want to follow you, is there a good way to do that?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter. I'm at Charles F. Lehman, and also always at City Journal.
All right. Thanks. We'll catch up again. That's Charles Lehman. Again, check him out. He's the contributing editor of the City Journal. One other aspect of this is we see these mass shootings. I think they're important to talk about. I mean, I've got a friend who goes to mass armed. Actually, he came on the program here about a year or two ago when we saw a lot of these. Now there's threats against pro-life organizations, threats of disturbing churches, and it may not just be people with hoods and signs. Maybe somebody will have mental illness like we just talked about. Maybe they'll be indoctrinated, you know, in this culture of death. And if you can take the life of a child, why not blow up a congregation? Why not set the church on fire? Why not bring a gun in and start shooting the priests and the people on the altar, right? Why not shoot the congregation? Why not? Right? Why not? You know, with the Buffalo shooting, a lot of people are left wondering, what would I do in that situation if somebody came in and started doing that? The people in the store were doing whatever they do Saturday, buying, you know, doing their shopping. They were going about their normal business. And all of a sudden, this kid walks, and he's a kid. He's 18 years old. After driving 3 hours, starts shooting. I don't know about you. I think most people are not prepared for that type of thing. Do you run and hide? I remember when these shootings were taking place, my wife and I and my daughters, we went to the Mall of America in Minnesota, right? Huge place, right? Monstrous mall. And I remember at the time saying to them, if anything goes on, because I think there were threats at the time, things might be happening in malls around the country. I said to them, you know, get to the back of the store and get out the exit. I mean, I just wanted to give them a plan. I just wanted to give some advice, and we'll meet here, we'll meet there. I mean, there was no strategy. There was nothing like I mapped out the mall. I just, you hear this, get down, get out, right? Make sure you barricade yourself in if the person's near you, whatever. I just think we need to be in the know, right? If Peyton Gendron had done that in a store, let's say in Texas, where a lot of people are armed, a lot of people carry weapons, it might have ended very differently. He specifically chose New York because he knew there would be very few people there that had concealed carry weapons. Since, of course, New York, the Empire, you know, state, their gun laws are so strict. Since most Americans aren't armed, about 8% of the U.S., I think that's the status. So about 8% is probably a safe number of U.S. adults. They have concealed carry permits. So there's a lot of people who don't have them. Right. Peter Johnson, who's been a friend of the program over the years, he's given us some advice on how you can stay safe. Maybe you don't have a gun. I get that. You know, maybe you're a little bit concerned with all that's now unfolding. Maybe you got to go visit a city like Chicago where there were 26 shootings, you know, or you got to go somewhere else and you're feeling a little nervous. What do you do? Peter's the founder of Archway Defense, and that is a security consulting and training firm in Minneapolis. And I've shared before, he was a former air marshal. He was their international team leader. He qualified as a top gun with them. He trains businesses and churches and a lot of other people on how to stay safe. And he's here today just to give some advice to you. If you want to join us, feel free to dial in. It's 888-914-9149. Peter, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
As always, thank you for having me.
Well, so more shootings. It's such a grim topic to talk to you about. I kind of hate it, but I do think it's important to, in light of all that we saw within the pro-life movement, what we're seeing with some of the radicalization, some of the mental illness, and just what we're seeing in general out there, this spirit of division and anger in our culture, we should be aware of what to do. These people were just going about their business, as I was saying, and this kid starts shooting. If you're there without a weapon, what advice would you give to listeners? What are the two do's if you find yourself caught in a similar situation, whether you're in church or whether you're in a store?
Yeah, so the unfortunately, again, we have another or a couple mass killings across the country. And if you are in those situations, the first thing is, before you get into those situations, you have to mentally accept that evil does actually exist in the world.
Yeah.
And sometimes as Christians, it's really easy just to look at the good in everybody. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that, except we can push out that element within our psyche that acknowledges that evil is real. Mm-hmm. And what happened at the church in California, what happened in New York, that is evil, to a T. So first, mentally accepting that people, there is evil in the world and people give in to that evil, that sets the tone for, okay, now I have to acknowledge there is evil, and ultimately nobody is coming for me in that very moment. And I know this is, sounds harsh, but we've talked about it before, that you are responsible for your personal protection. Okay. The video of the shooting in Buffalo, New York, was over within minutes, maybe minutes.
Yep.
By the time law enforcement gets there to help, it's generally, statistically, active shooter, active threat, or active terrorism is over. So in those critical moments, making a decision for yourself, obviously, if you can get out, get out.
Yeah.
The worst possible thing you can do is stop and freeze and start second guessing what you should or shouldn't do.
Right. So make a decision and go with it. If it's run, if it's hide, if it's fight, do what you have to do. Let's do this, Peter. I want to grab a couple calls. We got lots of questions for you. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. We have a caller in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the frozen tundra there. Paul, he was working at a Radisson in Green Bay when there was a shooting last year. Paul, thanks for calling in. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Can you hear me?
We can. Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. No, I guess it's not really a question. It's a comment. And I feel really sorry for those people that survived, that saw it and survived, because they're going to go through one heck of a year. And you don't get over it. I mean, I don't know. I've gone to so many counseling sessions, especially I'm still going to the diocese here in Green Bay, counseling there. And I went down the walk to Mary. Yeah. And, you know, anything that helps, you know.
So, Paul, let me just jump in here real quick. So you were in the Radisson. Somebody came in. There was an active shooter there. I'm assuming you have PTSD as a result of that, and you have flashbacks.
Yeah,
what happened, and what are you going through right now?
Well, that night, it had been the ex-food and beverage director. He had been terminated 2 months prior. We had knowledge that he was going to do something, but we didn't know what. He was stalking an employee.
Wow.
It was last May 1st. It was all over the news. He came in and he point blank shot two employees in the restaurant.
Wow.
And part of the problem was, I'm kind of digressing here, but that was called in because we're connected to a casino.
Right.
They said the restaurant and the casino. So when the police started arriving, they're going to the wrong spot on the property.
Yeah.
And so that meant, you know, they say normally 3 or 4 minutes, active shooter, and it's over. This is like from 7:23 to like 7:37. It was like 10, 11, 12 minutes before he was actually neutralized.
That's frightening.
And so I was security director at the time. And we were crisscrossing in the back hallways because he was mobile, kept moving around. After he shot the guys in the restaurant, everybody thought he exited the building. He did not. He made a big U-turn and came back in to check out his handiwork.
Oh my gosh! So
and then he was going, yes.
No, I was going to bring Peter into the conversation as well. So this guy is in there. I'm assuming the police, did they shoot him dead or did they ultimately capture him?
Right. No, they
shot him.
Yeah, because he was going to death by suicide by
a cop. Yeah.
So
here's the deal, and Peter, let me bring you into the conversation situation like that. I mean, you know, that guy, clearly there's something wrong. He comes back in to look at his handiwork, and there's a lot of very vulnerable people there. If you're and that's a casino, you know, or a restaurant, what do you do in a situation like that? But then secondly, for Paul, who he has these flashbacks and can't seem to heal. You know, I know you're an air marshal, and I mean, you've probably seen some action. What advice can you give to Paul to help find the healing he's looking for?
So we had this chat. Paul, obviously, I'm sorry you had to go. You went through that. But there is resources out there. And one of the best books from a perspective is the Body Keeps Score. If you want to dig into that one, it's been a phenomenal book, and maybe there'll be some insight in there. But a lot of the elements that Paul brought up are unfortunately similar in many attacks, as the attacker is actually statistically known to the organization or the location. So they're familiar with the environment, which brings another complexity to it when it's that targeted. And again, having that, what I said is you are responsible for your own personal protection. As Paul said, law enforcement, well-meaning, they got dispatched to the wrong location because of a communication breakdown.
Yeah.
So in those moments, each individual among us is responsible for our own personal protection, but more importantly, the protection of vulnerable and your family.
Yeah.
And taking that to heart and taking responsibility for that is it's unfortunately something that we have to face with sober reality.
You know, in fact, there's a call from Peoria, Arizona, a question about carrying a weapon to mass. Paul, first of all, we'll pray for you coming up, brother. I'm sorry what you went through, and I hope no one ever has to experience something like that. And we'll pray for God's healing for your post-traumatic stress, that's for sure. And for anyone that has that, trauma is a rough thing. But I want to sneak Michael in, because we have a couple minutes left here, and this is an important question for you. I know you train a lot of churches as well as businesses. Michael has, I think, a concealed carry permit. Michael, good afternoon. Why don't you share your story, and we'll get, get Peter's reaction.
I was just asking some questions, really. It's not that I've had any trouble yet. I'm just, you know, I see all these places where they've had shootings, et cetera, and I'm really mixed emotions of whether I should start carrying a firearm into church. I mean, what's that kind of telling, you know, what's that kind of saying about the United States in general? And I haven't had any problems, you know.
Well, here's the thing. Let me give you a quick response, and then I'm going to let Peter, who is the expert on this, give you some advice. I would talk to your local pastor. Say, you know, what's the protocol for keeping the congregation safe in the event somebody comes? Sometimes there are undercover police officers that attend church. You know, they have weapons. There may be something that the Knights of Columbus have determined. Maybe your church has a protocol for if there is an active shooter or somebody comes in to get out. But definitely talk to your pastor about that. But Peter, you train parishes and individuals for situations like this. He says, you know, I'm torn over whether or not I should bring a weapon to church. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so obviously you have to abide by your local state and local laws. Obviously get buy-in from your pastor, but also we're never meant to take on all struggles by yourself. If you can, what I've seen work extremely well at churches is when a group gets together under the guidance of obviously the pastor and finds time, talent, and treasure donations of people that are capable and willing to partake in a safety team, because this could include just medical response. Bridging that gap between the time something happens and first responders get in is, instead of looking at it, like I said, you're responsible for your own personal protection. Yeah. That being said, at a church, it's much easier to protect a church if you have more buy-in from more people within the community. I will say, anybody considering carrying a firearm in church, obviously you know our stance on it, we're all for it, under the very big asterisk that you go and make sure that your training is capable of responding, heaven forbid that situation happens within your church, because there are no misses. You cannot miss within a church. Heaven forbid you have to draw a firearm to protect yourself, your family, and friends. So if your accuracy, if your capability to maintain that weapon system and get accurate hits and never miss, if you're confident with that, as I am, then absolutely carry in church. But if you haven't got to that point within your own firearms training, please go get training first.
That's well said. Well, Peter, I got to hold it right there because I'm up against the clock. If people want to tap into your expertise, have you come out and maybe help their parish or business, archwaydefense.com, is that the best source?
as always, archwaydefense.com. Click the contact us button. We'd be happy to help, even just giving suggestions or recommendations.
That's Peter Johnson. He's founder of Archway Defense. Check him out, archwaydefense.com. When I return, I'm going to change gears. I have a question for you. Are you still providing for your adult child? Are you paying cell phone bills? Are you, paying food, electric, rent, something along those lines? I want to talk about that when we return.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
I mean, 63% of parents say that they've sacrificed their own financial security to be able to help adult grown children. So what parents need to do is set their kids up for success, help them to learn how to be independent by teaching them money skills and how to deal with it. Parents need to understand there's a difference between helping versus hampering these adult children. Help them do a resume, help them get out and get any kind of job to have income coming in. Your name is MOM, not ATM.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
I love that. Your name is MOM or DAD, right? Not ATM. Very, very good. I'm going to sound like an old man right now. You ready? And I'm not an old man, but I'm going to sound like one. You know, I remember when I was growing up, I bought my own car, which is true. I bought my own car. I paid for the own repairs. I went ahead and I paid for my auto insurance. I paid for my own gas, right? When I took my girl out, I didn't ask my dad, hey, Dad, can you lend me some money? I found a way to do it. I always had a job, right? I say this to my wife all the time. When I was 16, I bought my first car. When I was in college, I did this. I paid my student loan. I go through this litany of things that I took care of. Kathy and I, my wife and I, we have five kids, and we had them pretty close. They're, maybe a year and a half apart at the very most. We had a set of Irish twins. Our first two were so close. I struggle with this issue, to be honest with you, because I totally agree with what everybody says. Cut them off, right? Let them stand on their own feet. It's the best thing for them. Then on the other side, I think I'm softer than my wife. I think I'm easier than my wife. My kids ask me for something. Oh, okay. Hey, Dad, can you lend me some money? It's not lend because you never see it again, right? Dad, my tire went flat. Dad, I put them all on my cell phone bill, right? And I pay the cell phone bill, and they're supposed to pay me every month. Do I get paid from them? No. So I end up paying. Now, I know you're saying, well, Drew, that's your fault. You should be going after your kids, making sure they pay you. I know. It's hard. I don't know where you are as a parent right now with your own kids. Here in the United States, the ideal of our life since the 1950s has been for a couple to get married. You go, you buy a home, right? You start having kids. It's kind of the American dream. Then when those kids turn 18 or they move on to college, they start working a job, they move out of the house, right? They start their own family and they continue that same type of cycle and dream. Since the start of the millennium, though, and this is what I find the most striking, the number of kids who are not making that transition, they're not going out of the house, it's been on the rise. Now, I'd say, okay, well, the pandemic, I get it, right? During the pandemic, everybody was down. But during the pandemic, that number skyrocketed. Half of kids over the age of 18 are still living at home, and depending on their parents, for everything from food to shelter to cell phones to gas for their car, right, for their auto insurance. 62% of those kids who are at home are not contributing anything at all to the household expenses. Mom and dad are going out, they're doing the grocery shopping. Next thing you know, the fridge is empty, right? They're doing the wash, they're doing all these different things. That's according to a report from savings.com. Now, that's not the way many of us were raised. I wasn't raised that way. My parents made me a very independent child. But the amount of debt, here's the thing, and we'll talk to Dr. Meg Meeker about this, and I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to get your own experience. Things are a little bit different today, right? I think universities, they should wear a mask and carry a gun. I think they have hijacked so many students with these student loans. They constantly are raising the cost of tuitions. Kids go into this crippling debt. They're putting off marriage. They're putting off buying homes. They're trapped in debt So what happens? They end up going home. They have to. And then the parents are home. And for the first 18, 20 years, they've taken care of their kids. Just by default, you fall. It's no blame of the parents. I guess it can be if you want to. But I think there's a lot going on here. The amount of debt that kids have today with student loans, the way they're targeted for credit cards, the shutdown where kids were, you couldn't complete high school, where their education got seriously interrupted by means that they couldn't find work. A lot of those jobs went away. What are kids going to do when they can't work, right? There's no restaurants open. There's no places for to get those, you know, minimum wage jobs. So they go home. They start, you know, relying on their mother and father again. That could, I think, be a contributing factor to what we're seeing right now. But why they're not back at school, why a lot of kids are back home. Maybe, you know, it used to be a point in time where you didn't want to say, hey, I want to go to dinner? Sure. Oh, where do you live? Oh, I live with my mom and dad. You know, it's not super cool, right? Today, that's not the deal. Today, it's so totally different. I mean, it's like, yeah, I live with my parents. You know, it's like a lot of everybody does. It's not a bad thing. It is really not a bad thing. I love your experience. I'd love to know what you're going through and how you approach it. And I'd love the advice of Dr. Meg Meeker. She's a pediatrician, a mother, a best-selling author of 6 books. She's, of course, one of this nation's leading authorities on parenting. That's why I asked her to come by. And you can find her out. Her website's pretty simple. It's meekerparenting.com. Meekerparenting.com. Dr. Meeker, good to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thank you for having me on.
I am delighted. I'm so torn on this issue because as a parent, you know, I got a big heart. I always want to help, you know, anybody and everybody, including especially my kids. But then, you know, I also do see some parents who do this. They just, the kids get apathetic and they don't move on with their life. I'd love your view on this. I mean, where we are today, how did we get here? I mean, there's a lot of factors that play into it from debt to the pandemic. But I'd love to get your assessment of where we are, whether this is a cultural thing, a cultural shift, or whether we're in the perfect storm or we're going to get out of it. How do you read the winds today and where are we headed?
You know, I think it's interesting because a lot of people would read this study, a report, and say, well, you know, it's the economy. And gee whiz, you know, if kids didn't have, if we weren't in a, you know, have so much bad inflation, if we didn't have, you know, COVID and so on and so forth. So they really want to look outside of the issue. What I have seen over the past 20 to 30 years in parenting, this sort of parenting paradigm has shifted. And that is that children, even when they're young, when it starts when they're very young, have become the center of the home. Parents jump around their kids to make sure they have everything, the right formula, the right stroller, the right school, the right shoes, the right everything. And it doesn't end. Because I think that when you set that dynamic up, it's very hard for kids to break away from it and parents to break away from it. So I think that's a big issue. The second issue that I have seen is that it's very common with single parents, in particular single mothers, who may feel guilty, you know, that their son or daughter had to grow up without the father, or the father has the kids, they grew up without the mother. And so they feed into this because they feel guilty. They somehow want to compensate for hardships that the kids had. Bottom line is, either way, it cripples our kids. And I think kids don't have to be doing this. You know, maybe 5% of the people that are living, or the kids that are living with their parents, need to be. But there really is no excuse. There really isn't. You know, jobs are abundant today. I think this whole thing with tuition and colleges, while I understand it, there are a whole lot of kids going to college that don't need to be going to college, right, or they need to postpone their college. So I think those are the two big factors that I have seen play into this. And the other thing, too, is that parents don't want to let go of their kids.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to let them grow up. And this is particularly true. I wrote a book on mothers and sons, and this difficulty for mothers to allow their sons to break away and become a man. We want to be needed as parents, and we don't want to give that up. Yeah. That also fuels this phenomenon.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, as you're talking, another thought hit me. I have a sister who's a single mother, raised her son. but I could see it because we lived pretty close together and I had five kids and then we were all the same age. And, you know, she always wanted her son to have at least what my kids had, you know, and she sometimes would even spoil him to the point where, you know, she didn't realize that she loved him, but the father was not in the picture. So that was the issue, you know. I think divorce, here's the other thing, you know, ever since no-fault divorce entered in, we see a lot of broken families. One out of two marriages on average end up divorced. So what happens? When my kids are with me, if I'm a divorced dad, I want them to love me and I want to make sure they got everything they want. The mom does the same thing, right? So maybe this, it's not one thing, but a number of things that feed into this particular culture. And I never even gave thought to the fact that parents don't want to let their kids go. But I think that is so true, too. I think that's another great point. All right, let's take a few calls. If you want to get in, the number is 888-914-9149. Are your adult kids at home? Are you paying the phone bill, the maybe the car insurance? Are you paying, you know, the giving them money maybe to go out? Or are they living at home for free? You know, are you saving for your own retirement? A lot of parents, according to this study from savings.com, are they're putting off things like paying down major debt or even planning for their own retirement or their own health care at some point in the future because their children are there. And where does tough love come in? Where do you say enough's enough? Because I love you, you got to stand on your own. Carlos is listening in Chicago. He's 19 years old, Dr. Meeker. He wants to talk with you. Hi, Carlos.
Hi, Drew. Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
19. Your son is 19.
My son is 19. I wish I was 19, Drew.
It would be. Yeah, if I knew then what I know now, Carlos. Holy cow.
Yes. So here's the thing. My son, he's going to be 19 next month. He's going to school, and he's got a part-time job. He doesn't ask me for anything. He's becoming independent, but I don't ask him for anything at home either. He bought his own car. I offered to pay his first 6 months of insurance. And then is that just as bad as giving them stuff since I'm not asking him to contribute anything at home?
Do you want to answer, Drew, or do you want me to?
No, that's all you, Doc.
Yeah. Yes, that is a bad thing. And I'll tell you why. Because in order for a 19-year-old young man to have self-confidence and to establish his identity as an adult, he needs to be able to contribute, to take care of himself, and even to help take care of you. And when we take those things away from a young man, we're really crippling him and saying, you need me. You need me. You can't make it on your own. If he's living at home, you at least needs to pay rent, and he needs to contribute to household chores. And he needs to have a sense that, you know, he's fortunate to be there, that this is a privilege. It's not a right. But I really do think by withholding those demands from him, mm-hmm. you are keeping him from feeling like a man. He feels like a boy.
Yeah.
And if you want to make him feel like and be a man, he has to stand up and he has to contribute. And the minimum is he has to pay you rent. Otherwise, he's going to start taking advantage of you and he will stay in perpetual boyhood.
That's so true. Such a good point. Carlos, I share your pain because believe me, I've had kids who stayed home with me, you know, as young adults as well, and didn't pay anything for the house, you know, while we were home. Dr. Meeker, it's tough advice. I think you're on point. And I think, you know, if kids stand on their own feet, their confidence level increases, you know, and they're able to navigate other challenges in life. I've got to take a quick break here. When we come back, let's pick it up because, you know, there's an epidemic going on right now. I want your take on this, too. And we'll grab a few more calls of anxiety and depression. So some of these kids say, I can't go out. I've got crippling anxiety. I can't keep a job, or I'm so depressed. I don't want to work. And some kids are, you know, passive aggressive. Yeah, I'm going to get a job. And they never go out and get that job. We're taking a look at parents providing for their adult children. If you want to join us, you can dial in now. Our conversation continues right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Changes. Turn and face the strange.
Changes.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Great to have you back with me. Thanks for joining me. 10 minutes. We'll pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. If you're just tuning in right now, as a parent, how old are your kids? Huh? Are they teenagers now? Are they young adults? You know, are you still supporting them? You know, do they have a job? Do they get a job when they were 16 or 15? I'll sound like an old man again. Get off my yard, right? I'm like, I was mowing yards when I was like, you know, 13 to 14 years. They say, I forget what the percentage of top Fortune 500 CEOs are that had jobs before they were 15. I remember seeing it somewhere, and it's like off the charts. These people who achieve great success have this work ethic built into them very young in life. But today is a little bit different. I mean, it is. We as parents, you know, have the mindset we want to take care of our kids. They struggle with anxiety and depression. They there's a whole litany of things that are going on. There's a lot of debt. There's a totally different cultural milieu right now. My guest, Dr. McMeeker, joins me today. She's one of our nation's experts, leading authorities on parenting and teens. And doctor, let's just jump right back into the phone. Let's take a few calls for you. Start in Youngstown, Ohio. Claudine, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Thanks for joining us.
Great. I just want to say that I totally agree with how entitled our young children are today. I'm a preschool teacher, and I see it even at a 3-4-year-old level. And I have two daughters. One is 27, one is 23. And when they were 18, they weren't sure if they were going to go to college. So I said, well, that's fine. You decide what you want to do, but you're not going to sit on the couch, and I'm going to pay for the phone, and I have to ask to borrow my car. You're going to get a job, and you're going to decide what you want and pay for your car and, you know, all these responsible things. And then they decided what to do. They both, one does hair, one does nails, and they're both successful, and they both own their own business. And one just got married, so she moved out with her husband, and the other one came to me and said, I'm moving out, and they're so independent. And the husband, my son-in-law, and they're boys, she has the mother of two boys, and she literally, I just laugh because I'm like, it's because of you moms who do not create them to be men.
Okay. It's a good point, doctor. Let's pick it up because time is a little bit precious here. Claudine making the case that, you know, parents never say no. It starts when they're young. I mean, how important is that early formation in all this?
Oh, it's terribly important. It's critical, actually. And I think that another thing parents don't want is they don't want their kids to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And they don't want their kids to struggle. They don't. Yes. They want to make sure that their kids get straight A's. And if they don't, they're going to get a tutor, or they have to be the best person on the soccer team, or else they're going to get a special coach. We need to allow our kids to struggle. It isn't mean to make kids work. Our kids all work under 15, doing really menial jobs, because we wanted them to understand what hard work was all about, even if it's babysitting, if it's mowing somebody's lawn. And I think that makes kids feel good. But because we see every other parent out there indulging their kids and paying for their cell phone, we feel that we need to do that too. And if we ask something from our kids or demand it, we feel that we're being mean, but we're not. We're being good parents. If your child or your student can't afford to go to college, have them work for a couple of years and save their money. Yep. Go to a community college and move on. But there are a lot of different ways to do it. But don't cave to indulging your kids just because other parents are doing it.
I remember hearing from one parent one time who says her biggest regret was not allowing her kids to do more when they were young. For example, you know, they want the kids to clean the room or make the bed or to do whatever the chore was, but the kid never really did it well. So the mother ended up doing it instead. The father didn't let the son mow the lawn because he wanted it done right. And as a result of that, you know, those kids never, and they said, that's the biggest mistake we made. We should have given them more responsibility instead of us saying, hey, we want to do it right. And to your point, you focus on academics, focus on being the best at what they're doing. You don't want your kids to suffer. You don't want them to fail. Failure's not a bad thing. And we can learn from our mistakes.
If you look at all the great leaders in history, they've all failed. But they've known how to go shake it off, try again. If you don't know how to fail, you can't succeed.
That's right. That's
because
a great point.
People don't just succeed right out the chute. So we have to teach our kids to fail. We have to be willing to accept that they tried and, oh, well, they weren't very good at soccer, so they're going to move on to something else. It's really okay. It's good for your kids to not mow the the yard very well, but make them keep trying.
Yeah, I remember going to hearing a motivational speaker somewhere. I forget where I was, and this guy led off by saying, "Don't show me your successes," because people all want to lead with, "Oh, I've done this, I've done that. Here are my." He says, "Show me your failures. Show me your failures." Yeah. That's what he wanted to see. Andrea in St. Charles, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you? Good.
Great.
I was just going to say. You know, we kind of told her, we have two girls, one's out of college, one is finishing college in a semester. And, you know, we told them when they were young, we're like, your education's your job. Your dad and I work very hard. We expect you to do very well in school. That's your job. And now they also had side jobs, but we made it clear that that was a very serious responsibility. And, you know, they're very blessed. They were very good students. They worked their butt off and worked very hard. And our one daughter graduated from college. We told them that we would pay for their college education as long as we felt their choice of major was a good financial investment, but we were not going to pay for any major. And, you know, thank God we thought their passions were good investments. So our one daughter graduated last year. She was able to get a job right away. She has her own apartment. Great. I'm so proud of her.
Good.
And our other daughter will be graduating next semester. And, you know, but we just told them from the time they were very young, this is your responsibility. And you have to carefully decide what you want to do. I mean, I would love someone to pay me a lot of money to pet puppies all day because that's what I really like to do.
Yeah, right.
But well, we can't make a living at it.
Andrew, thank you for sharing that. Congratulations, too, on raising two very successful and wonderful daughters. I'm grateful for your call. I have a minute or two left, and I do want to sneak Tim in here very quickly because he has an adult child who he's paying for everything. Tim in St. Cloud, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Drew and Doctor. I've got two boys, and both couldn't be very any different from each other. One is the younger one is very successful and gone to college, got a 4-year degree, is paying for a student loan, and paying his way on just about everything. My oldest is only 15 months older and can barely hold down a job, struggles with depression, anxiety, sexual identity, and, you know, I pay for his cell phone, I pay for his car insurance, I paid for his car. Yep. His car is currently broke down, he needs another one. And I just am, he's at 26 now where his health insurance is going to be on his own here shortly. I just don't know how to break that cycle.
Hey, what a good question, Tim. You are not alone. Believe me, there's a lot of other fathers the same way. Meg, I've got about a minute and a half. Please, I'm going to leave you with the final thoughts, especially for Tim.
Well, you know, you are in a difficult situation. And if your son is clearly really depressed, he has to have that treated first. But I would remind parents of this. When kids are having a struggle, you don't want their struggle to be an excuse for them to not be able to move forward. As a matter of fact, one of the most important things to do when a person is depressed is to move forward, is to engage in something, to get outside, to have a job, to function. Because the worst thing somebody with depression can do is stay stuck. And that's probably what keeps, you know, people depressed, too. So don't feel so sorry for him that you indulge him and don't let him to move forward. But depression is a serious illness, and you have to be aggressive in helping him get that under control.
Meg, thank you. Dr. Meeker, always good to have you here. If people want to check you out, I know the best way to do that is just go to your website, right? They can check out your books and tap into your resources. That's Meeker Parenting. com. I'll be right back. We'll pray the chaplet. Let's pray for our kids and to be good parents.